You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's market time in Central Alameda, one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Los Angeles. On South Central Avenue, several dozen canopies shield fruits and vegetables from the sun. Flies swarm to get out of the heat. This open-air market is a great convenience for Orlando Zepeda. He came to the United States from El Salvador more than 30 years ago. He lives right around the corner in this largely immigrant community. He's got a little two-bedroom bungalow that he owns and shares with his wife and two kids.
Mostly every day on Thursday, they do the farmer's market, they call it. They do on the street. They put tents and they got everything for sale. I got there. Yeah.
That is where the laughter stops. Orlando is one of about 400,000 immigrants living in the U.S. legally in danger of being deported. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb picks up the story.
Lovely. I think just, that's her.
Hello? Hello? Yeah, he's here now.
Great, thanks.
Okay.
Before Orlando and I get to talking, his attorney calls from the ACLU. Orlando is here legally in the U.S. on a program called TPS, or Temporary Protected Status. It allows nationals of certain countries to stay in the U.S. if they are here and something catastrophic happens back home, like the outbreak of war in Sudan, for example, or a natural disaster like the 1998 hurricane in Honduras. In the case of Orlando, it's a devastating earthquake in his native El Salvador from 2001. There hasn't been a lot of national attention paid to this group of people since the program's inception, but things have changed. The Trump administration wants to send most people who are here legally under the TPS program home. In all, six nations are at risk of losing their status: Honduras, Haiti, Nepal, Nicaragua, Sudan, and El Salvador. Orlando's eyes fill with tears when we start to talk about this. His daughter's tiny dog sitting protectively on his lap.
I feel like I have lived all my life here. And that's it, because I came here when I was only 16 years old. I have lived my whole life here. And when this decision comes, it was very sad to hear. I was angry because we deserve to be here. Because we have our own life. We have very deep roots in this country already. I have my two kids. And they need us. They don't know. They haven't been in my country. Even when I went back to El Salvador, there were places that I didn't know because I came here when I was a little too.
Next to him on the wall of his living room are pictures of him in Washington, D.C. He's been there a couple times, he says, lobbying Congress to pass a law that would allow him and other TPS holders to stay permanently. And there's been plenty of activism on this issue, too. Protesters recently descended on Pasadena, where the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals meets. A panel of that court is currently deciding whether or not to lift an injunction that's stalling the sunset of these protections. In other words, this court could strip away legal status from TPS holders, or they could let them stay. Hundreds of them and their supporters showed up that day to protest and to celebrate. Like Fernando Flores, he's also from El Salvador and has been working and paying taxes in the U.S. for 18 years. He feels like he has earned the right to stay here.
Es una situación muy dura, ¿verdad? Porque es una separación y luego
It's a hard situation, he says, because deportation would involve families being separated.
Hemos pagado y contribuido a la economía de este país por 18 años.
And he says, I'm not asking for a handout. I've earned the right to stay in the US. Fernando's preteen daughter Michelle has been torn apart over the idea that her father could be deported. She was born here in the U.S. and came with her father to protest the administration.
I really love him, and I don't want him to leave my side because it's really, like, just sad for me. So, like, I really don't want him to leave. And, like, I really, really love him. So, like, I don't want him to leave. And it's really sad to know that it's his last opportunity.
This reality of family separation affects TPS holders not just from Central America, but across the world as well. Ebtihal Abdullah is a citizen of Sudan, and she could be deported back to her East African country if the injunction keeping her here in the U.S. is lifted by the courts.
I have kids. They are U.S. citizens. So either I have to leave them here, and that's not an option, take them with me. My country is not their home, so I decide to step forward and fight so we can all stay together.
Ebtihal, like other TPS holders, is here legally with a work permit and the ability to travel outside of the U.S. She's at risk of losing that, too. Ahalan Arulananthem is with the ACLU of Southern California. He's the guy that's arguing on behalf of TPS holders in the courts. And he says that if TPS is rescinded, people would start feeling the effects pretty quickly.
They would lose their employment authorization. So you can expect that the vast majority of those people would be fired. We know that the job participation rate for this group is extraordinarily high, as you would guess. And that means a few months after that, in many of the cases, they'd lose their homes. They would lose their cars. Those who are paying their children's college tuitions or high school tuitions, you know, would deal with all of the downstream financial ramifications of that. It's also true that they all immediately would become subject to deportation.
Which is a big part of President Donald Trump's agenda to reduce immigration into the U.S. In the case of TPS, the position of the administration is that conditions have improved in these countries. Here's Gerard Sinzdak, an attorney arguing on behalf of the federal government before the Ninth Circuit.
We are not here contesting that the plaintiffs will suffer harm and the balance of equities tips in their favor, but plaintiffs nonetheless must show that they are likely to succeed on the merits of their claims or at least raise serious questions about those claims, and they do not do so here.
Others, like Mark Krikorian with the Center for Immigration Studies, are calling for these types of protections to be thrown out entirely. The center is a think tank in Washington, D.C. that wants to restrict immigration.
They have no right to remain here, but prudence would suggest finding a way to let them stay lawfully. But that cannot happen unless the TPS law is fundamentally changed.
Krikorian says the U.S. should no longer be in a position of offering temporary legal status to immigrants with no way to determine when temporary is over. I brought that up to Ebtihal. She wrote a declaration for the court in this case. And while she agrees the program isn't working properly, in her mind, there is a major disconnect in the politics.
They don't see it. They don't know exactly what is going on in the other parts of the world. And they just close their eyes from the way that we suffer.
Last week, the Trump administration granted a reprieve for Salvadoran TPS holders. It gave them a one-year extension. And that means they'll be allowed to live and work legally in the U.S. until January 2021. But the other groups, well, they're not as fortunate. If the injunction is lifted, they'll lose their work permits and legal standing right away. A decision is expected in the coming days. For KCRW, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Well, as you just heard, a panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is weighing whether or not to strip temporary protective status holders of their status. Since taking office, President Trump has worked hard to nominate more conservative judges to the Ninth Circuit, which represents California and eight other Western states. And with me to talk about those changes, what they mean for California and the nation as a whole, is John Michaels, who's a law professor over at UCLA. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
How much of a change have we seen in the Ninth Circuit since President Trump took office?
So we've seen significant change, actually. There's been a number of appointments that the president has made. More generally, the president has made significant numbers of appointments to all the federal benches. But we've seen a marked increase in the number of appointments in the last 2 years on the Ninth Circuit. I think there have been 8 confirmations in 2 years, and there are 3 more pending. That's a pretty high number for 2 years of any administration. In the 8 years of the Obama administration, there were 7 Court of Appeals judges named and confirmed by President Obama. So just to give you a sense of scale.
A sense of scale. Of course, there was a Republican Congress that did not push forward a lot of his nominees, correct?
What's made it easier to push appointments through is in 2013, the Senate ended the filibuster, which meant instead of needing 60 votes to confirm a judge in the Senate, you needed only 51. And so that kind of opened the floodgates considerably. But even with that lower threshold, by the latter years of the Obama administration, Senate Majority Leader McConnell was doing his best to bottle up a number of the appointments, most significantly that of Judge Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court vacancy that was left with Justice Scalia's passing.
With Justice Scalia's passing with nearly a year to go, right, in the Obama presidency. Let's talk more historically about the Ninth Circuit and exactly how it was created. Like, this goes back to Jimmy Carter's years, right?
Yeah. So there were a number of spots opened during the Carter years. I believe it was 1978 that led to it just happened to land in President Carter's lap. Someone who didn't, for instance, get a Supreme Court nomination, but happened to get to drive the kind of jurisprudential agenda of the Ninth Circuit for decades. So it turns out they created a bunch of new judgeships in basically the Western United States. Carter filled those, and of course he filled them with folks of a similar jurisprudential leaning to that of the kind of mainstream Democrats, and that created a path dependency that there were so many more, let's say, judges who shared kind of an outlook or a constitutional vision consistent with that of what we associate with Democrats. It's hard to, you know, I don't want to use the term Democratic judges and Republican judges because I think that's oversimplifying things and a little bit misleading. But it is fair to say that presidents look and senators look for judges who share their kind of legal values.
The Ninth Circuit has been a headache, obviously, for Republican presidents because it is the largest. It represents about 20% of the American population. It's got a reputation for being, if we don't say Democrat, we say more liberal, right? So the reputation came because of Jimmy Carter filling many of those slots in 1978. But then over the years, I mean, through attrition, obviously, things change. And that's where we are right now, correct?
So things change. And so part of it is just demographic in that, you know, vacancies do not open up on perfect scheduling. It's not as if all the Carter retirees were replaced in the Clinton administration or the Obama administration. You know, some of them were replaced under George H.W. Bush. Some of them were replaced under George W. Bush. And so over time, things have balanced out to a considerable extent.
Does that mean then when a vacancy comes up in the Ninth Circuit, because it's a Western circuit, that it has to come from those 9 states, California and the 8 other states?
It doesn't have to, and there's been some controversy about that. In fact, with one of the recent judges that the president has named or the Senate confirmed, who grew up here but spent his professional life in Washington, D.C. So there's always a little bit of concerns about things like that. Historically, the home state senators have had much more influence over whether a judge could be put forward. And that practice has largely died away. I mean, essentially, the California senators have opposed, I believe, each of the Trump nominees to the Ninth Circuit from California. And that historic practice of senatorial courtesy.
Are you talking about blue slips?
Mm-hmm.
Explain what a blue slip is.
So the practice, which was, you know, there's no constitutional rule for this. It was just a historic practice of kind of interbranch comedy to allow the senators from the home state to basically give a thumbs down to a judge that they oppose in their state. And that would essentially be like a veto mark, a veto point. And over time, that practice has largely died down, and now it's been pretty much altogether abandoned, so that the home state senators have no more influence over the vote of a judicial nominee than the senators from any other state.
With these changes that have happened, especially with the Trump administration now and the president himself nominating people for these vacancies, are we seeing a tilt now from a left-leaning court to a more right-leaning court?
So I think it's a little too early to say, but I think that is likely to be the net effect, as it is under most administrations. Under most administrations, especially if the president serves for 8 years, historically it's been a he will bring the court into either the Republican or the Democratic fold, the conservative or the more liberal fold, and the jurisprudence will reflect that. And there'll be cases that'll come out more friendly to those interests that are most closely aligned with the party in power. There is something called in-bank proceedings for high-stakes cases. And for high-stakes cases, it's essentially all the active judges sit down and decide a case, as opposed to simply just a three-judge panel. When you have three judges on a large court and they're chosen randomly, you may have three of the most liberal judges, or you may have three of the most conservative judges who happen to just find themselves in the courtroom together on a given day when your case is being argued. So there's always that statistical glitch. But by and large, the more conservatives are on the court, the more likely you're going to appear before a conservative-leaning panel.
Well, I suspect the person who makes the decision on who goes to the panel is a pretty powerful person, right?
It's a lottery.
Oh, it is a lottery. It's like, is it the little ping pong
balls? Otherwise, I don't know the exact approach and whether it's computerized or whether it's in a hat, or I don't know the process. But otherwise, you are absolutely right. It would be devastatingly strategic for who gets assigned courtroom A and who gets assigned courtroom B.
UCLA law professor John Michaels, thank you for your time, sir. We appreciate it, Professor.
My pleasure. Take care.
Oh, fly, fly, fly like an eagle. Coming up, the road home from LAX is paved with good intentions, but a week later, there's no shortage of opinions about the ride-hailing system there. You're going to hear about it next on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It is spelled LAX-IT. It's pronounced LA exit, as in fly into the airport and then make an attempt to exit the airport. Except exiting has become a journey unto itself over the past week or so. If you're an arriving passenger seeking a taxi or a rideshare, you're going to have to walk or jump on a green shuttle bus to a parking and pickup area next to the airport, next to Terminal 1. And that's where you can get in line for a ride. Sometimes those lines are 10 minutes on good days. A lot of times those lines take an hour or more just to get to your ride. Obviously, reaction, for the most part, has not been good.
Honestly, I think this is absolutely horrible.
It seems a little confusing. Like, we're not even sure if we're standing in the right line.
It's different because usually I come off, my plane, I get my bags, and then I just find my Uber within a few minutes.
It's actually been all right. I feel like we heard worse, but it's actually been okay. Got on the bus, got here, got in the queue, and it's been okay.
What a horrible idea. Who was in charge of this?
Well, the folks at LAX were in charge of this, and starting tomorrow, they're going to try and make it better by increasing the size of the lot by 50%, hoping to help the situation for now. Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor at Curbed LA. She's here to tell us what is happening with LA Exit. Hi, Alyssa.
I keep pronouncing it LA Exit.
No, but what they're trying to do is LA Exit. You're trying to exit LAX, right?
I think it's like LA Exit is what I'm saying. The reason they're doing this is because they're expanding the airport's capacity overall, right? We're making all these improvements for the Olympics or because we're adding all these tourists every year, record-breaking tourist numbers every year. So they're building a people mover down the middle of the horseshoe is what everybody calls it, right? So a people mover will be able to get you from one end to the other and connect you to the Crenshaw line, which is under construction right now. This will all happen by 2023. But in the meantime, they're going to lose about 30% of their curb space to construction.
It's going to be that bad, right? You know, what is so interesting to me is that they have, I'm sure, they have all this information about how many people, passengers use the airport. I know it's somewhere north of 80 million or 75 million per year. And they have, you know, how many cars go in and out of the horseshoe per day. They count these things, right? But it seems like all of this wasn't taken into account. Do you think they took these things into account?
Well, I think they did. Their estimates have been pretty much right on because they guessed that it would reduce the volume of cars by 15%, and it did. And the other things that are going really well are that because of those vehicles are off the horseshoe, 6% of traffic has been reduced for the arrivals deck, but also 35% of the traffic has been reduced for the departures deck. So that shows you that your ride is going to get speeded up even when you're leaving the airport, and that's how many TNC vehicles, as we call the Uber and Lyft vehicles, were using both decks to drop people off, pick people up. It was, you know, kind of anarchy for a while. But I think what we have to remember is that matching people for rides with apps is very inefficient. If you look at the taxi waits, even through this system, even though you have to go to this other lot, the taxi waits are much shorter.
You said it's more efficient. It's faster going through the horseshoe up and down, right?
So right.
Does that mean it's working?
It is working in that aspect. The horseshoe has been sped up. The vehicles that are taking the people from their curb to the lot for their ride-hailing pickups are coming every 2 or 3 minutes, just like they're supposed to. They have these dedicated bus lanes. So it's not just the shuttles, these little shuttles to get people to this lot, but it's also like the flyaway, airport shuttles, hotel shuttles, car rental shuttles. Those are all moving faster. I think what they didn't do, though, is step up the options that would have helped people take public transit from the curb to try to incentivize these modes that are shared or more sustainable and making sure that we can get more people in fewer vehicles to get out of the airport.
And as is per usual, what we see is now the people who have more money will be able to get in and out quicker.
Right. I mean, this is what's so backwards about the current system. If you book an Uber Black car or a Lyft Black car,
this is the fancy Uber,
the
right?
Fanciest ones, the big SUVs, you get picked up at the curb right away. And then the next tier is you have to ride a little shuttle to get to this parking lot to get the other, you know, lower grade Uber and Lyft. But you still get...
Is that plebeian Uber? What is that? Which Uber is that?
But you still get bathrooms, you get free water, you get food trucks. Okay, now then look at the tier below. If you're taking transit, you go to the city bus center at the airport, no bathrooms, no snacks, no great shade systems, right? So we're really rewarding the people who are taking the least efficient, least sustainable mode of transit.
So it's like a caste system at the airport.
That
is
describes airports
there?
Very well, I think, in general. You're first class all the way, right?
And until these improvements happen, it will be... Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor over at Curbed LA, and of course, our regular here at Greater LA. Alyssa, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Oh, man. Well, that's it for today. I bid you good traffic wherever you are and no lines. Tomorrow, remembering those who died 1 year ago in a Thousand Oaks mass shooting, a community still grieves 1 year later. Next on KCRW, it's DNA with Francis Anderton. We, by the way, are online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast there. By the way, it's a little yellow icon there. You just put the cursor there, click, and then you're in. Subscribe to the podcast. We'd love to talk to you each and every day. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl all helped make today's show possible. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ear. Thanks for your time. Have a great day.